If you've been tracking with us over the last few weeks, you know we're in the Gospel of John. So if you've got a Bible, grab that out. We're in chapter 21 this evening. So turn there with me as we continue to explore our last message in the Gospel of John. It's the 46th in the series. So we've obviously gone through it pretty rapidly. But this is the last one. So it's kind of a very nostalgic night. Let's pause and enjoy that for a while. Everyone found John 21? That's a great clip because it's a real challenge for us. Is your faith still in kindergarten? Comfortable is not necessarily best, is it? Yet comfortable is what we so often strive for. I just want to be comfortable. I want to be safe. I want to be secure. I want to feel like I know what's going on. I know what's expected. I know the routine. I know I can do it. But comfortable is not always best when it comes to our faith, when it comes to our education, or most other things in life. That guy was most comfortable in kindergarten. Not many of us would identify with that. Obviously, it's a pretty extreme thing to get a point across. But in our story today, we see some people who went back to what they were comfortable doing. And it's a pretty realistic thing that they did. And I wonder if we're going to see some similarities in our lives as we go through the story. Let's pick it up at John 21, verse 1. You might remember, if you were here over the last couple of weeks, that in chapter 20, Jesus had appeared to his disciples as a group and he'd given them a commission. He'd appeared to them and said, just as the Father sent me into the world, I'm sending you. They'd been given that charge and they'd been told about the Holy Spirit who was going to be their empowering presence to enable them to do that mission of being Christ's ambassadors. Now he's gone, he's disappeared from them, and we pick up the story in chapter 21 a little while later on. Verse 1. Afterward, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Galilee. Last week, we were talking about a time in a room in the city of Jerusalem. Well, that feast that they were attending, that week-long feast of Passover, is finished. They've now returned back to their hometowns, their home areas. And we pick up the story of seven of those disciples who were fishermen, who were from the Sea of Galilee. And this is what's going on for them. It happened this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, also known as Didymus, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two other disciples were together. I'm going out to fish, Simon Peter told them. And they said, we'll go with you. Now remember from last week, they'd been given a commission. Yeah, granted, the Holy Spirit hadn't been given yet, so that empowering presence of God inside them in order for them to be able to go and do the task that God, Christ had given them, that wasn't yet their experience. They were still operating on their own resources, and they clearly didn't feel up to the task. So instead of strategizing, instead of planning, instead of going and doing anything related to the mission that God had given them, what do they do instead? I'm going back fishing. This is what they knew how to do. This is what they used to do before Christ called them. You would have heard the story that Carolyn read out from Luke 5. The story there is that you have these guys and they'd been checking Jesus out. They'd gone to listen to John the Baptist. John had pointed to Jesus. And Peter and John and these others had been listening to Jesus and finding out what he was all about. And they were quite impressed. But nevertheless, they went back to their profession of being fishermen. And Jesus, on this occasion, comes to where they're working. And he identifies himself to them by miraculously, after a night where they hadn't caught anything, telling them to throw their nets over the other side. They pull in this huge catch of fish. And on that occasion, it took a couple of boats to tow it in. And Simon Peter's reaction was, whoa, you are somebody out of my league. You are somebody pretty special. I'm too sinful to have anything to do with you. He realizes that Jesus was somebody special. And Jesus says at that time, now I want you to leave these things behind. I want you to come and follow me. Leave your nets behind. Leave your boats behind. Leave these fish behind. Come and follow me. Be my disciple. And it was an interesting journey because these are guys who are not qualified for being a disciple of a rabbi. You might remember weeks and weeks ago we talked about what would normally be the process, and that is that Jewish boys would be educated in a group in a synagogue, in their local congregation, and they would get a basic understanding of reading and writing so that they could read the Old Testament scriptures and be able to profit from that. But for those who were very gifted, they would be invited to study further. They might have a career as scribes or teachers of the law. They might become religious leaders. Those who weren't particularly academic, who didn't have a future in scholarship, they were told to go back and learn their family trade and that would be their lot in life. And that's what's happened to these guys. They obviously weren't the brightest of students. They've gone back to their family trade. They've been rejected, in a sense, by the rabbis and by the teachers as not being up to scratch. And they've gone back to ply their trade. They're unqualified. And Jesus comes along as a rabbi and says, but you're the guys I want. These ones who are apparently unqualified, they're the ones Jesus, the ultimate teacher, they're the ones he wants to train for ministry. It's surprising, isn't it? Do you ever feel like you're unqualified? You look around and you think, oh, you know, that person, that's a gifted person. This guy over here, man, he's bright. This lady, man, she is so talented. Do you ever look at other people and go, wow, they're qualified, me? Or maybe you're like Peter and it's not so much your qualifications academically or in terms of giftedness, maybe it's your moral qualification that you're aware of. You know what? I spent a night not catching anything. You know how many times I swore during the night? You know how often I get angry and violent? Do you know how much I tell half-truths, myth-truths? I'm not really qualified morally to be a teacher or somebody who wants to guide others in doing what's right and doing what pleases God. I just don't have it within me. I fall so short. And yet, this is the guy Jesus chooses to say, come follow me and I'll teach you how to become a fisher of men. Wonderful story of how these disciples were first called. And I think it's a real encouragement for us. We're in Missions Month. And over the month, we're going to be hearing lots and lots of different stories. We're going to be hearing from organisations like Gideon's and Youth for Christ and many others. And there's so many great stories of people who have gone into ministry, organisations doing ministry. And we might be going, oh, is God calling me to this? Is God calling me to this? Should I support? Should I go? And there might be that element of, I'd sort of like to, but I just don't feel qualified. And the story of the disciples is, hey, it's not a matter of whether you feel qualified, it's whether you've been called. Who remembers the story of Samuel in the Old Testament? Here's a great example. He hears God's voice, Samuel, doesn't know what to do with it. And I reckon sometimes Christians are a bit like that. We feel that prompting inside us and a tugging, but we don't know what to do with it. What did Samuel need to do? Well, he had a mentor, Eli, who told him what to say. And so he said to God, speak, Lord, for your servant is listening. And then God gave Samuel a commission and he went on to become Israel's greatest judge. And really the focus for us as a church, where we're at right now, where we're going over this next month, is to have that attitude where we want to say, speak, Lord, for your servants are listening. We're listening as a group of people to how you want to guide us to do the things that you want us to do, to follow you in the ways that you're leading us. And we're listening as individuals, whatever it might be. It might be to do things in our current vocation, or it might be to support somebody else in what they're doing in whatever way we can, or it might be to step out of our current vocation, whatever it is that we're doing now, to leave our nets behind, so to speak, and go and do something else in order to follow Jesus. That's a possibility. You might not have ever thought about it before. You might think, well, I'm too old. I'm past that. We've got some displays out in the hall from the Second Wind Network, and they're looking for people who are in those years of life where they've got time and they've established themselves and now they can invest themselves in kingdom work. Lots of opportunities. You might think, I'm too young. How old are the people you're looking for again? Young. All right. God uses young. He uses old. He uses the obviously gifted. He uses the shy and retiring. He uses anybody. And he uses guys like these disciples. Common fishermen, didn't think there was anything special about them, but Jesus came along and said, I want you to follow me. It's a great story, and I hope we are as open as what these guys were to being called. What did they do? They left their nets and they followed Jesus. Well, that was a few years back. Now, some things have changed, and they've had a great ministry, great experiences. They've learned a lot. They've grown a lot. They've been inspired. Peter himself was the one who realized and said, you're the Christ. This isn't just a great teacher. This is God himself come to redeem God's people. This is who they're following, and it's exciting. And then Jesus gets taken away and tortured and killed, and their world is shattered. And since then, Jesus has appeared to them, but they haven't yet put all the pieces back together. They're not quite sure where to from here. They haven't really embarked on that new stage of their calling that Jesus was preparing them for, that he promised to help them through. They're still in that in-between, are we going to do this or aren't we? And so they've gone back to what they're comfortable with. Have you ever dreamt of going back to school? Sometimes I sort of imagine what that would be like to go back to, you know, when you could play basketball for an hour at lunchtime and half an hour at recess time, and when, you know, the responsibilities weren't so heavy. Yeah, sometimes it's sort of nice to think, oh, when life was good, you know, I spend all afternoon at the beach, and or was that university? I can't remember. But yeah, you sort of think of these comfortable times. Oh, if only I could return to that. But you know what? We're actually made for something more important. We have a calling, every single one of us. In Ephesians, we read that God has prepared good works in advance for all of us to do. And it looks different for all of us, but we all have good works prepared in advance for us to do. And Jesus now comes back to these guys and he says, I need to remind you of what happened a few years ago. Remember when I called you to something? Remember when I said, leave your nets behind, leave the fish, leave the boats, leave your father's trade? I've got something different in mind. Well, you've gone back to that. Now I want to remind you, I've got a different plan for your life, and I need to set you back on that plan. And that's what he does for these disciples. He gives them an experience which takes them right back. What's happened? They've caught no fish, just like a few years ago when they caught no fish. Professional fishermen, they always love it when they don't catch any fish. And this guy in the very early hours of the morning appears and says, haven't you caught anything? And they go, no. And I wonder if deja vu is starting to set in. But because it's early morning, they can't recognise this person. He's about 100 metres away on the shore. And this person, who is Jesus, calls out, says, have you caught fish? No, they answer. Verse 6, Jesus says, throw your net on the right side of the boat and you'll find some. This is starting to feel familiar. I wonder if there's a bit of excitement building. So they throw their nets over on the other side of the boat. And what happens? They were unable to haul the net into the boat because there were so many fish in it. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, so that's John, says to his mate Peter, it's the Lord. And as soon as Simon Peter heard him say, it's the Lord, he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he'd taken it off, and jumped into the water. The other disciples followed in the boat, towing the net full of fish, for they were not far from shore, about 100 yards. And when they landed, they saw a fire of burning coals there with fish on it and some bread. And so Jesus has prepared a meal for them. And I wonder if at that point they go back not only to that fishing experience where they had the miraculous catch of fish, I wonder if they're going back to the meal they shared only really a short time earlier before Jesus was taken away and crucified. I wonder if that's got that feel to it for them. Jesus says in verse 10, bring some of the fish you've just caught. Simon Peter climbed aboard and dragged the net ashore, and it was full of large fish, 153. But with so many, the net was not torn. And Jesus said to them, come and have breakfast. None of the disciples dared ask him, who are you? They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came, took the bread and gave it to them, did the same with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. So he's appeared to them strategically. They've gone back to what they're familiar with, and he's saying, remember, I've called you out of this. I've got a different plan in mind for you. And he goes on from there to deal with Peter specifically, because Peter has some real issues that need to be discussed. Remember, last time they were all together as a group, and Jesus had told them, one of you guys is going to betray me. And so they're having this discussion, and Peter very boldly says, you know what? Doesn't matter if all of these other guys betray you, I will never do it. I will stand with you to the end. I won't let you down. And he's full of bravado. And Peter's a guy like that. He's the guy who jumped in and swam to shore 100 metres. I don't know if I'd do that fully clothed voluntarily. But I wonder if the guys in the boat overtook him or how that all worked out. It'd be interesting to know. But yeah, he was the guy who acted on impulse. And yep, I can do this. But yet he failed, and we've talked about that. He denied Jesus three times around a fire with people in the early hours of the morning. And so Peter, probably around this fire, some of the memories of what he did around that fire might be coming back into his mind. Yeah, he was full of bravado, but he'd actually denied Jesus three times in groups, probably not much larger than the one he is currently a part of. And so verse 15 continues, when they'd finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Well, more than what? Is he looking at the boats and the nets and the fish that Peter's gone back to him and saying, do you love me more than these? Can I call you away from this again? Maybe. Maybe he's looking at the other disciples and saying, Peter, remember when you said that even if all these guys fell away, you wouldn't. You know, you love me more. You can stand firmer. Do you really love me more than what these guys do? Well, we don't really know, but it's possibly the latter. Anyway, Peter responds and says, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And Jesus said, "Feed my lambs." He's reinstating Peter in this role of being a shepherd of people. "Feed my lambs." Again, Jesus said, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter answers, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And Jesus says, "Take care of my sheep." Verse 17, the third time he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" He said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." So this is a real emotional time for Peter. In asking three times, it brings back the memory of the three-time denial. And Jesus is giving Peter an opportunity. "Well, you denied me three times. Here's your chance to affirm three times." Yeah, it's a bit of a raw wound. You know, this is a sensitive thing for you, being tested on this. But you know that you've fallen short. Now I'm giving you a chance to say, "Yes, I will stand with you. I do love you. I genuinely love you." Despite what had gone on previously, despite the fact that you failed, he's being given an opportunity to reaffirm his love. And Jesus responds, "Feed my sheep. Very truly I tell you, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you don't want to go." And Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, "Follow me." So as Peter reaffirms, "Yeah, I'm going to come back to that calling. I am going to feed your sheep. I'm going to take care of your sheep. I'm going to play the role that you called me to all that time ago, all those years ago. I'm going to go back to that. I do love you enough to do that." And Jesus says, "Well, there's going to be a cost. It's going to cost you your life. And when you're older, you're going to stretch out your hands." Now, I tend to think of stretching out your hands like that, but as the passage indicates, this is Jesus giving a clue as to the type of death Peter would suffer. And by tradition, we understand that Peter was also crucified. Similarly to Christ, according to tradition, he didn't feel himself worthy to be crucified in the same manner as Christ and was actually crucified upside down at his request. Whether that's actually how it played out, we don't know, but he gave his life for his Saviour, Jesus Christ. He was able to stand firm and follow through on that calling. And Jesus here indicates to him, "Yep, I know that I'm confident that you are going to follow through, that you are going to follow me, and I want you to know that this is what is in store for you." Very often when God calls us to something, not all the time, but very often, he lets us have that indication, that awareness. You know what? In doing this, there's a cost. And before you agree to this, you've got to know what that cost is. You've got to know what you're signing on for. In fact, if we look back to Luke chapter 9, from verse 22 onward, this is before Jesus was crucified. He's letting people know what's going to happen. In Luke 9, from verse 22, he says, "The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests and teachers of the law. He must be killed and on the third day raised to life." So he's letting people know what it's going to cost him to do the ministry that he was called to do. Verse 23, "Then he said to them all, 'If anyone would come after me,'" exactly what he's asking Peter to do and exactly what he's asking the other disciples to do, "'follow me. If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me.'" Remember, the cross wasn't just a symbol of dying, of being killed. It was a symbol of utter humiliation. It was a symbol of rejection. It carried a lot of meaning with it. "For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me will save it. And what good is it for a man to gain the whole world and yet lose or forfeit his very self? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his glory and in the glory of the Father and of the holy angels." They're strong words, aren't they? "If anyone's ashamed of me, I'll be ashamed of him." What a terrible situation to find yourself in, that you've been ashamed of Christ and you've got the feeling of, "Does this mean that he will be likewise ashamed of me when he comes, when he evaluates my service? Will he be ashamed of me?" They're very strong words, and Jesus is wanting us to understand that if we want to be a follower of his, it means that there are certain realities that we're going to have to face. It might cost us our lives physically. It might cost us our standing. It might be a shameful thing for us. We might risk rejection. We might risk humiliation. We might risk financial costs. The costs could be experienced in all sorts of ways, and we've got to count that right at the beginning. Because to be a follower of Jesus means to be somebody who is prepared to pay the price, whatever it happens to be, for you. And it's interesting, at that point, Peter turns around in his conversation with Jesus after Jesus says, this is the kind of death you're going to die. Peter turns around, and from verse 20 in our passage we read, Peter turned and saw that the disciple whom Jesus loved was following them. And this was the one who had leaned back against Jesus at the supper and said, Lord, who is going to betray you? John doesn't identify himself. We know it's John. When Peter saw him, he asked, Lord, what about him? Well, you've just told me that you still want me, and I've got this call to follow you, and I've taken it up, and it's going to be costly, and in the end, it's going to cost me my life when I'm older. What about John? Is he going to get it easy? Is he going to get a cushy job out of this? You know, how does it compare? And Jesus answers very diplomatically. I'll even use Jesus' own words. If I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? But before that, he says, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, that's it. If I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? You must follow me. And because of this, the rumour spread among the believers that this disciple wouldn't die. But Jesus didn't say that he would not die. He only said, if I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? In other words, Jesus is saying, what is it to you? All right. If it turns out that my will is for him to live to 3,095 in a palace, that's none of your concern. What your concern is my call for you, not my call for John. That's a challenging idea, isn't it? Because how often do we look around us and go, you know what, this is the kind of life I want. I want a house like his and a car like hers. And we sort of judge what we can expect out of life based on what God has given to others. What if God's call for us is to actually give up all of that stuff and go to a place where there are very few comforts? What if that's God's call for us? Oh, I'm just not sure if I can be cut out for that sort of ministry, Lord. Surely there are people who are naturally inclined for that sort of thing. And I wonder if God would say to us sometimes, if I want you to do that, then that's my call for you. And what I want for other people, what's it to you? If other people have more than you do, what's it to you? If other people have less than you do, what's it to you? What you need to be concerned about is what my call is for you. Are you going to follow me or not? It's a good challenge. I wonder whether we might be a little bit like those disciples who have gone through an experience, or maybe it's just time that sort of dulls our passion a little bit, and we've actually lost sight of our calling to leave behind our nets in whatever shape that looks like, and we've gone back to doing what's comfortable, or we've sort of eased into doing things that are comfortable. And Jesus wants to come to us and say, you know what, I gave you a calling and you've lost sight of that, and I want to remind you of that. This is your calling, go for it. And don't worry about what anyone else is meant to be doing. I'll deal with them. You do what I've asked you to do. Count the cost and do it. Are you going to step up or not? Or I wonder if maybe this is a new opportunity for you and you've never had that sense of God saying, this is what I want you to do, but maybe you're ready for it. And a bit like Samuel, you just need a mentor to say, you know what, just ask God what he wants you to do. He'll reveal it, and then you need to be obedient. And so maybe there's going to be a fresh call for you that God is going to share with you, maybe through some of our guests who come along and speak and show you some of the possibilities that are out there for serving our Lord. Maybe that'll happen over this month. I'd be excited to see both of those things happening, and I'm looking forward to them happening, because God has a call for each one of us, and we all have a tendency to lose sight of it. And this is our chance as a community to say, God, what was that call? Are we following you? Do we need to be reaffirmed in that? Maybe we're a bit like Peter and there was something that happened that knocked us back a little bit, and we need an opportunity to have that dealt with. Jesus dealt with his guilt. Maybe Jesus needs to deal with stuff in your life, whatever it might be. And maybe this is the time to do that, so that you can be on call for him. I'm going to read you a little story of how one lady discovered a call for her life. It was something that she hadn't wandered away from. She just had never received it before, a particular experience that she had. And I haven't read this book in its entirety yet. I saw Carolyn reading the introduction. I said, what's that? And borrowed it when she was doing something else. And as I read the first chapter, I thought, this is a great illustration of what we're on about. There's a woman dying nearby. Please would you come with me to pray for her, the pastor asked. Well, how could I refuse? We walked along sandy tracks, the heat of the sun searing my head. I'd left my sunnies behind and everything seemed bleached of colour. We arrived at a round thatched hut and I paused before entering. I'd never been inside an African hut before and I felt hugely privileged to be doing so now. I was totally disoriented by the darkness of the interior in comparison to the brightness outside, and for a while I stood motionless and blinking, trying to get my bearings. Finally, I made out a form lying on the ground to the left of me. This was the woman we'd come to pray for. She was lying with her face turned towards the wall of the hut. I knelt down beside her, gently touched her on the shoulder. The pastor introduced me and explained why we had come, and she barely responded. As my eyes adjusted to the light, I gradually became aware that the poor woman was lying directly on the mud floor in her own excrement. I was mortified. "Right now, this lady needs a wash more than she needs a prayer," I exclaimed. "Please, can you fetch me a bowl of water and I'll help clean her?" The pastor and one of the woman's family members lowered their eyes and looked embarrassed. "There's no water," they said as they shrugged their shoulders. "There's a severe drought. Normally, we can get water from the river 10 miles away, but there's no water. The river has dried up." I felt a strange singing in my ears and the world seemed to somersault. The polarity of my life in the UK and life here in Zimbabwe hit me with powerful force. "Please fetch me some toilet paper," I said, somewhat naively. "What is that?" was the reply. The pressure was rising in my chest. I'd never felt so impotent. Bizarrely, a picture crossed my mind of the comfortable pink and grey chairs in the HIV unit I worked in at Charing Cross Hospital in London, and the tins of Quality Street sweets on the waiting room tables. And someone brought some rags. "I'm going to roll you over and make you more comfortable," I whispered to the inert woman. Holding her frail body in my arms, I gently turned her towards me. And at that moment, I was shocked rigid. Only years of nursing experience prevented me from crying out loud. Gazing at the woman, I found the entire right side of her face was missing. Her eye, cheek and lips eaten away by what appeared to be untreated herpes, an infection common with those with compromised immune systems, such as those with HIV. At the clinic at Charing Cross Hospital, we would simply put patients on a course of acyclovir tablets at the first sign of a blister, and the problem would normally be resolved. Now, here was this precious woman dying on the floor without so much as a paracetamol. And the pressure in my chest exploded, and all the anger against the injustice I had seen in the past few weeks suddenly erupted. I was furious at God. I remained silent, but as I held the woman in my arms, I shouted out to him in my heart, "God, this is obscene. What are you going to do about it?" It was then I heard his voice, soft and gentle, inside of me. "The question is, Susie, what are you going to do about it?" That was it. Everything went into freefall at that moment. Life would never be the same again. That was the moment she heard her call. And it's different for each one of us. It might take the shape of something as dramatic and as confronting as what she experienced to be the clarion call that says, "You need to be involved in this. You need to be a part of my solution to this. You need to be my hands and feet, my grace and love and mercy in this." Maybe that's what it could look like for you. Maybe it's to be sharing with a neighbour or a family member or somebody in your community who is going through relationship difficulties or just experiencing the hopelessness of life without Christ. And that's how you're to be Christ's ambassador, to share with a person maybe next door, maybe in your own home. It's different for each of us. What matters is that we listen. And when Jesus says, "This is what I want you to do, this is the price that I want you to be prepared to pay in order to serve me," maybe risking humiliation, maybe it's a financial gift that you're being called to give, maybe it's time in prayer that you're being compelled to spend. Whatever it looks like for you, will you spend it? Will you do it? Will you commit yourself to it because you've heard the call? And like Peter and the other disciples in this story, you say, "Yes, yes, Lord, I'll follow you. I may have fallen in the past, but because of the cross of Christ, I've been forgiven. I've been raised to my feet again and dusted off and set on the path of following Jesus' call." That's where we're at as a church family, and I hope that's where you're at individually. You might already have a strong sense of that call and are actively pursuing it, or you might be at a stage of life where you're ready for God to reveal it to you or to remind you of it. My prayer is that as we go out this week, that every single one of us will have a sense and a knowledge that we are called. Whatever it looks like, we're called. Will we obey?